Welcome to the BISCOS Pediatric Orthopaedic Digest or podcast. It's a panel discussion of what we regard as the most interesting published papers of relevance to pediatric orthopaedic surgeons. Please do remember the views are our own and not those of the BISCOS board, committees or membership. Right. Hello, guys, ladies and gentlemen. This is the BISCOS Pediatric Orthopaedic Digest podcast, and it is September 2023. Do you know, I actually don't know how many of these we've done now, but I think they've all been amazing. That's what people tell me. You all love them. That's what the BISCOS survey may have said. So it's me, Anish Singrajka. We've got Alpesh Kothari, Pranay Budev producing. And today we are fortunate enough to be joined by Alwyn Abraham, who is a consultant pediatric orthopedic and adult limb reconstruction surgeon from Leicester. How are you doing, Alwyn?
Really well, thank you, Anish. And it's obviously a pleasure, and it should be fun to be with you today. Thanks.
Should be. Sound a bit hesitant there.
I was trying to find the right words.
to make it fun, why don't we start with telling a bit about yourself? So the first part, as an avid listener, the first part of the podcast is a vehicle by which we and the listeners learn about the great work at units across the UK. So I was hoping you could tell us, just give us a bit of an overview of the Peds Orthopaedic Department in Leicester and a bit about your practice, if that's okay.
Yeah, so I've been a consultant for 16 years now, appointed 2007. I was very fortunate to be appointed at a time when there were two very supportive senior colleagues. Chris Kershaw, who retired about 5 years ago, and Andrew Furlong, who's been a consultant for about 10 years longer than me. So I was very fortunate to be part of a team that was in the three different phases of consultant life. Someone starting out, someone in the middle, and someone coming to the end of their consultant career. We've expanded from three to five now, and that's, I guess, the trend in most hospitals, an increase in consultant staff. We cover roughly about a million catchment for children's orthopedics, and for some of the slightly more complex things, then we get up to 1.5 million, something like that. There are some very complex things which we send elsewhere, but most of the stuff that we see and do is managed in-house. So that's a very brief snippet of children's orthopedics life in Leicestershire.
Great. And what about your practice? What floats your boat?
So I don't know how many of you know Richard Montgomery, who sadly passed away at the beginning of last week. So this is a little plug in his memory too. I was very fortunate to be his registrar right at the end of my registrar career in the Northeast, and Richard had me for not just one attachment but two, just before my CCT. Being his registrar, then I was completely taken by ring fixators, Ilizarov, infection, non-union lengthening, and that's where I've continued to enjoy my practice the most. And I do that for kids, but I think more commonly I do that for adults now, because Leicester needs that at adult level. We're not an MTC, so we require someone with limb recon experience for adult work, and I'm very pleased to say that I'm able to offer that. More recently then, it's a case of finding significance in my career. So I've taken on TPD work, I've taken on head of service work. I happen to be both at the moment, which is very fulfilling. And then the other huge part of my career has been an interest in developing orthopedics on a global stage. And I have a very close link with developing orthopedics in the northern part of Ethiopia, particularly.
I was reading that in your bio, and that was particularly something I wanted to ask you about. So your role in developing the Leicester Gondar partnership. I mean, actually, I thought Gondar was somewhere in Middle Earth, but it turns out north
Ethiopia. That's Gondor.
Gondor, sorry. You've probably never heard that one before, but
One vowel makes all the difference between somewhere in heaven and somewhere in Africa.
Yeah, so you only put like one or two lines, but I'm sure there's so much you could tell us about it. Please, sir.
Yeah, okay. This is the blessing of having a registrar. So Lawrence Winks, he won a traveling award with WOC. And he went, when he was my registrar, he went to northern Ethiopia. There's been a link with Leicester and Gondar. I think early 90s is when it started, when there used to be an organization called THET, which I forget what it stands for, but it was a tropical health educational trust initiative set up by the government to improve healthcare and particularly medical education in parts of Africa, Asia, with places with lesser resources. And Lawrence was the first orthopedic surgeon to go out to northern Ethiopia. And the second time he was going to go, he said, "Alwyn, you need to come with me." And that was 2015. Since then, I've been a visitor to Gondar 7 times. I've seen a very basic general surgery department grow into a dedicated trauma and orthopedic department. I've seen a general surgical theater now transform into a dedicated trauma and orthopedic theater. I've seen one general surgeon now become a team of 6 or 7 consultants with a residency program. And I think most importantly, I don't know how much of the kind of African news you guys follow, but there's been a really traumatic civil war in northern Ethiopia from about, it was about 2020 to 2022. And it ended up being a frontline trauma care service for a large number of young people, mainly young soldiers, who otherwise would have had no treatment at all. And when I went there last in December 2022, then I saw the Lazarov technique on view. I saw fixations on view. And when I first went there in 2015, that was a pipe dream. I would never have thought that 5-6 years later it would be in practice, but that was a really powerful example of what we in the more privileged setting can contribute, like Pranay is doing in Tanzania.
It sounds like it's amazing work. It sounds like what you've got going is also sustainable as well, in terms of you can dip in, dip out, but there's a whole infrastructure there kind of just working away autonomously without excessive input, which is, I guess, the key, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I've realized with my visits, the key is about forming partnerships and encouraging people to realize that they can do stuff. They need partners to give them the confidence, partners to help with some of the details. But in places like Ethiopia, the bonus is the hugely motivated, interested workforce, and that needs to be harnessed. And I think they're at the stage when they really need to develop the rest of the service by themselves. And they've got ideas and aspirations for sarcoma work, for spine work, for complex hand work. We've sponsored someone to go and do pelvic anastatabular work in India. He's going back, and I've seen some of his sacral screws, and I mean some of his work is really amazing. And this in a place which 2015 when I first went didn't even have a C-arm, to now being able to do minimally invasive screws and so on, it's an amazing achievement for the people of northern Ethiopia.
It's a couple of questions there, Alwyn, actually, if you don't mind.
One
is, find easier in terms of driving change and making things happen, the work you've been doing in Ethiopia or your work as service leader at Leicester?
Which do I find easier?
Yeah, if you had to drive change and introduce, because it sounds like you've done so much in Ethiopia.
Yeah, I think they're both easy in some ways, in individual ways, and I think they're both complex in some ways. So in in Ethiopia, then it's a very pragmatic mindset. Whereas here, it's a very idealistic mindset, isn't it? We have certain standards that we aspire to. And then those standards come with a lot of regulation, a lot of cost, a lot of education. Whereas in Ethiopia, it's much more pragmatic. You know, if we don't do anything, this person is going to die. Or if we don't do anything, this person's not going to have a leg at the end of the day. So they approach things in a very different way. So the challenges are different, I'd say. And in different ways, it's easier here, and in different ways, it's easier over there.
Yeah, and in a way, I suppose it complements each other, the kind of thinking you're having to do here, the thinking you're having to do there. One other question then before we move on to the papers, but it's just because it is topical. So here you are, training program director, so looking after trainees on one hand, looking after a service on another. How have you found dealing with the strikes? Because that's the big topic right now, isn't it? Has that, because as TPD, the trainees have got to be your priority. As service director, it's got to be about the service. How have you managed to cope covering services? And what do you think the impact is going to be on training in the months and years to come?
So I think in terms of answer the first question, last question first, I think the impact currently is fairly small. So the strikes are reasonably sporadic. I think they've maybe been a total of, I don't know, 6-8 days of strike. So in the grand scheme of things, I don't think the effect on logbooks or MCRs has been that great yet. Obviously, the longer it carries on, then we, you know, in a year's time, if we're still sitting here and talking about this, then the effects could be much more profound and far reaching. In terms of providing a service, then I've been very fortunate. You know, we in Leicester, we have a very mixed workforce. We have trained ANPs, we've trained physician assistants. So some of the emergency cover that we need, we've been very fortunate to have at our disposal because there's a group of people who aren't striking. Okay. And that's a difficult kind of juggling act, isn't it? Because, you know, keeping them on side, making sure that they don't feel put upon, that's been challenging. So I think we're fortunate we have other people who can help us, so we're not completely at the mercy of a medical workforce. So that's helped. I think the other thing is that I think because of people's convictions, then some people have chosen to strike and some people have not chosen to strike. And again, you know, we've not had a 100% mass walkout. We've had people either striking or not striking. So we're fortunate in the sense that some of us are left on site, able to provide some semblance of a service. But, you know, to say that it's the normal service is far from the truth. It's not. The backlog in terms of the elective care, I mean, that'll be self-evident. But equally, in the trauma setting, the main effect is the backlog with, say, fracture clinics, minimal provision, and the long wait to get even a first appointment after an index injury. You know, it's really challenging to get those in.
It's probably since 2020, who knows what a normal service looks like these days anyway, right? We're going from one thing to another. Right, last question before we move on. Was that a bear that I just saw leaving your through the door?
Yeah, it's a bear. It's a big dog. Yeah. It's a Bernese Mountain Dog. I don't know, any of you guys got a dog?
I got two.
Yeah.
You got two? What kind of dogs have you got?
I got Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. Like, your dog would eat my dogs for like...
Probably, yeah, yeah.
What, that would be an amuse bouche.
It's a 50-kilogram dog.
Man.
You just need to make sure your knees are not in the way when it's running towards you, because you don't want a Shatska 6 tibial plateau fracture if it bumps into you. Yeah.
Well, then you would probably get post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Very good segue.
onto your paper. So, Alwyn, why don't you tell us about your paper?
So, I mean, the background to why I chose this, I guess, you know, you might be curious as to why I chose this, but I've chose this because I, over the course of my career, I've realized that as orthopedic surgeons, we have very little training into the biopsychosocial model of pain. We are are essentially conditioned and taught that every symptom must have a physical explanation. And if there isn't a physical explanation, then it's, you know, back to GP. I'm sorry, there's no surgical target. Can you please sort them out? And it's a really bad state of affairs for a large number of patients. And we're seeing some of that even in arthroplasty now, aren't we? So if you, I know we shouldn't talk about arthroplasty, but knee arthroplasty has a huge, they have a huge vexation with, you know, what do we do about the knee arthroplasty that's still painful, even though it has a perfect alignment and perfect articulation. So I found in my pediatric career that there was a very large number of patients whose symptoms I simply could not understand. And so that, I think, started a journey of trying to understand why. Why do people have pain? Why do they have pain even when scans and x-rays are normal? Why do they have pain when physical examination is normal? And then that led me into, you know, the whole combination of physical health and mental well-being, which I think is, you know, it's a very closely linked one, and one which I don't think we necessarily teach, or we don't kind of enact in our practice. I don't know if this makes any sense to you guys.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah,
100%.
So there was a on the just on the back of our interest, I was very fortunate to partner with a consultant in pain surgery, and I'll just give you a little bit of a background. He did a very large audit into chronic pain in the county, because he provided a service for Leicestershire, and you know his findings were very out of like 1,000 patients that he audited, the best part of 50% were MSK related. You know, they came to him from the MSK service, so it's the majority of his work, half of his work was coming from MSK. It was only the other half that came from the other specialties, like, you know, pediatric surgery, or pediatric gynecology, or pediatric rheumatology. So that was a huge amount of work. And I thought to myself, you know, is there some way that I can essentially give these people almost like a one-stop pain service? Do they really have? And that's the other thing. I don't know what your service looks like in your parts of the country, but there's often a huge wait, you know, so you get chronic pain on top of chronic pain because these people are waiting 3-4 months. So this is the background to my interest in chronic pain, and I've come out with a sequence of consultations which I think works for me, and I'm pleased that I can avoid the chronic pain clinic in many cases of kind of atypical pain, or pain which is not explained by the classic orthopedic history examination and investigation. So that's where this interest in PTSD comes from. And the headline of the paper is 15% of orthopedic trauma patients who are kids end up with some form of PTSD, which is essentially some form of anxiety-related symptomatology, isn't it? I don't know if this makes any sense to you guys.
Yeah.
Shall I pause for a sip of water while that sinks in?
So this is a paper in the August edition of the Journal of AAOS Global Research and Reviews. And it was interesting. It's found, you know, from the what we could read there, it's been funded by Posner as a startup. And yeah, it was a really good study, isn't it? It's children having surgery for orthopedic trauma. So not the elective conditions, not the kind of chronic pain things.
Yeah.
I have to say, I thought, so they don't say exactly what the injuries were. It's not necessarily clear whether it was polytrauma or an isolated lower limb injury. And I wasn't sure what to make of the 15%. So they gave them a questionnaire, didn't they, and got them to fill in this questionnaire themselves. And I think they themselves said that because they were doing, am I right, was it at 6 months that they did this? So they thought they may have missed a few. Some might have actually
got
better.
Between 1 and 6 months, yeah. Right. So, and I think that's why they, throughout the paper, they were quite measured. So they just said incidence of post-traumatic stress symptoms.
Yeah.
So they're not saying they've got PTSD, because actually I think, you know, you need to have the symptoms for at least a month or so before you can be diagnosed formally. And so I think they were just quite balanced in their perspective. The guy's out of Boston, isn't it? Lead author Ben Shaw. It was interesting. They did look at injury severity as part of that. So I think there was some polytrauma, but yeah, it was a bit of a Ron Seal paper, I thought. It kind of, you know, it sort of did what it said on the tin, I thought. But
yeah, and I think it gives us something to kind of bear in mind when we see patients, you know, when the fixation looks perfect and you think, well, you've got the limb aligned, why are they still in pain? And I think there's a huge interplay between the physical and the mental side of well-being, especially in that complex teenage phase of life. And I think they say that is one of the predisposing factors, isn't it? It's yeah. Adolescents are more likely. And those of you who've got teenage kids will know that there is a very complex way that teenagers perceive symptoms. It's always the worst. It's like a knife in my body, Dad, you know, and it's just a headache or something. But yeah, you know, it's a very complex interplay between physical and mental health, especially in that group of patients. And I think it's worth bearing in mind because there will be patients in fracture clinics, in trauma clinics, whose symptoms, you know, you can't explain physically. And hence I chose this as a theme, just to make people aware that we, you know, it's worth bearing in mind.
You mentioned age being a factor, but then they also found patient sex and undergoing previous surgery were also associated. So, you know, girls particularly. And I think this is something we observe generally in clinic, or I certainly do. And it kind of makes me think twice as well when I'm thinking about certain investigations, whether a GA MRI can be justified or not, because all of this is extra trauma, which is going to stress the kid out even more.
Yeah.
And I think that was the thing in this paper, is they actually said it's not. So those are the three risk factors, but ISS, the injury severity score, wasn't related. And you'd have thought that that would be the main thing. What I did like was their little screening tool. So they said after ABC, consider the DEFs. So the distress, the emotional support and the family. And if you read the paper, you'll see they break that down. So it's quite a nice thing. And as you said, Alwyn, I think it's just about raising awareness. But I suppose the problem with this is we need the time, don't we? When you're working in fracture clinic, you almost want a simple screening tool. And especially for the guys that get admitted to the ward, to pick up these problems and deal with them. Because I think it can, you know, sometimes you're seeing patients even before you operate on them, when they've been admitted overnight, where you can sense there's going to be issues. And actually, it'd be great to use this screening tool to see if it does help that post-operative care and the pathway. So I think it's a really interesting thing, but I think the start of a load of work that we need to do, right?
Yeah.
Any other comments about the
paper? Oh, sorry. What was that?
Sorry, guys. As you say, how is it going to change your practice, Alwyn?
Well, it's a point that I try and educate my trainees in, that you know, whether you like it or not, you're going to have to deal with people's psyche. It's not just about fixing a bone, fixing a fracture. It's about trying to holistically deal with many patients. I think fortunately the vast majority of patients will be straightforward, but there will be some patients who will tax you and who will come back again and again and again, and they will be really unhappy. And in the context of, especially in the context of kids, it's not just the anxiety in the child, it's often the anxiety in the parent that drives it. So this paper doesn't mention it necessarily, but there is something known as caregiver hypervigilance. So you can get an anxiety type disorder even in parents, which is measurable. That's a different piece of work. But this is in many ways, this has given me some I guess some material to help further make my colleagues and my trainees aware that if you want a happy patient, in some instances the x-ray will be in most instances the x-ray looking good will be enough, but in some patients you'll need more than that. And you can apply this not just in children's trauma. I think the lessons here are even in adult trauma, but also in adult elective practice.
Brilliant. So shall we move on? So in terms of our rundown so that's our long paper. We're going to talk about some shorts now. And we're going to cover a variety of topics as we always try and do. The first couple of papers that caught my eye in the last few months were about septic arthritis. And I think BISCOS have done some great work with the MSK in infection in children guidelines in the last few months. Alwyn, you were involved with that, weren't you?
Yes, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that has pushed things forward, but it's amazing how many people out there don't know about those. So if you are listening and you happen to not have looked at those, please do Google that. There's a boast based on that. But the first paper I want to talk about is from JPO, September 23. And it's from New Zealand, Christchurch, and it's by Ninke et al. And it's called A Comparison of Clinical Prediction Rules in Preschool Children with Septic Hip Arthritis Due to Different Pathogens. And actually, I thought this was a really interesting idea. Okay, so they want to compare the Cocker and what they call the modified Cocker's criteria. Now, I have to say, okay, my personal little bugbear here is it was never published as the modified Cocker criteria, was it? You just think, Paul Michelle Caird from CHOP publishes this paper, and Cocker's name is ascribed to it, and she disappears into the ether. So I think that's a little bit unfair. But what they were doing was comparing those two criteria, looking specifically at children between the age of 3 months to 5 years with septic arthritis. Now, apparently, I didn't know this, but in New Zealand, they actually have a database. They've got a retrospective multicenter study that's gone on. And this was a secondary analysis from within that group of patients. And what they essentially hypothesized was they thought that the Cocker criterion modified will work better in children with Staph aureus infection than in Kingella, because we all think Kingella is a little bit less virulent, don't we? We always think it's a bit more subtle and it's harder to pick up. And so basically, this was Australia and New Zealand, 11 hospitals between 2012 and 2016. What was interesting is they said the cases had to be confirmed by either radiological findings, microbiology, or surgical findings. And one of the following: a CRP of over 5, an ESR over 20, or a temperature of over 38. So actually, in my opinion, that's overcalling it. Okay, so they've actually set the bar quite low to say it's infection. In their population, they found that Staph aureus was present in 22% of cases, Kingella in 16. So if you're writing an MCQ, Staph is still the most common organism, even in that age group. One third of Staph aureus infections had concomitant osteomyelitis. So this is around the hip, compared to 15% with the other organisms. So if you're going to consider MRI scan, have a higher threshold, well, lower threshold, sorry, in those with Staph aureus. And what they found was the median CRP was only 34 in Kingella kingi compared to 44 in Staph aureus. And as I say, when I'm teaching my juniors, CRP over 20, and that's what Caird's paper said and a load of other papers. Okay, I think you've got to take that seriously. Now, the headline of this paper, though, I think the thing to take home was the sensitivity of Cocker's and Caird's criteria was less than 60%, whether you had Staph or whether you had Kingella. So I really think we need to stop talking about those criteria. I think it's a really good idea to hang your kind of thoughts on, but it just hurts every time I hear. I've even heard pediatric orthopedic surgeons say, oh, Cocker's criteria are great. That's me on my soapbox. What did you guys think about that? And what are your thoughts about Cocker's criterion care? Is this where, Alwyn, you announced that you love them and you stand by them religiously?
No, very much like you. You know, I think it was quite obvious from the BISCOS working group that there was a universally held view that there wasn't one scoring system that was necessarily predictive, and I think that went into the guidelines, if I'm not mistaken, Anish, to suggest that there wasn't one particular scoring. But yes, you know, in an age when MRI scanning is much more easily available, then I think we are all much more in favor of the Peterborough view that if you're over 20, then it probably requires some kind of imaging, and MRI probably the best to try and get a diagnosis.
And how about you, Alpesh? Any thoughts on that paper?
Yeah, it was fine. It was one of those papers. It was like we started with loads of patients. We're only going to tell you about a small number of patients. And I think that's highlighted because their criteria of septic arthritis was quite broad, potentially. And then there was this concept of lower limb dysfunction. Obviously, their age group is like 3 months, I think, to 5 years. So a large proportion of those will be non-ambulant.
Yeah.
So obviously they won't be walking, so they get one straight away. So then they had to sort of fluff it a bit with this lower limb dysfunction, which seemed a bit not very well defined, I thought.
Yeah.
I agree. I'm not a massive fan of the Cocker criteria.
No, but it's still there, isn't it? Everyone's still talking about it, but hopefully we'll make change over years to come. And then staying on that theme, another that I thought was really interesting. Now I have to say it's from this year in International Orthopedics. It's by Eugene Cohen and it's from Israel. But unfortunately, I can't tell you the month because some of these journals will only give you, it will say first published online March 23. But I'm not sure exactly which volume it was in, but it's been in the last 3 months. I can promise you that. Because we looked at 35 different journals over the last 3 months to catch all these papers, so you don't have to. And essentially, they were looking at the treatment of septic hip. And what they did was compare needle aspiration and lavage with arthrotomy. And I think this is an interesting topic because a lot of people are saying, well, if you can't open the hip, and maybe you don't even need to open the hip, we can just use needles, wash out the hip. And it is quite big in Israel, is my understanding from previous conferences I've been to. I've never been brave enough to do that. Are you guys, would you wash out the hip or are you happy? No, there's heads being shaken right now. But I've always wondered, is it because we're just old-fashioned? We're too scared to move on, right? So in this, they basically tried to compare the two. Now, the first thing they say is these were all kids that were thought to have septic arthritis of the hip. And it was surgeon preference. And it sounds as though, as is the case in many hospitals in the UK, they have a general trauma surgeon on call. So not necessarily pediatric orthopedic. And so some surgeons would choose needle aspiration and lavage, some were doing an open arthrotomy. And what they wanted to do was compare three factors. Okay, the first was scar cosmesis using a special scar assessment scale. Now, I'm not sure why you had to do that, but maybe people were thinking, ah, oh, they're not bothered by the scar that you perform surgery. They compared post-op pain and then the complications. And so in their series, they had 94 children that were eligible, but only 80% that were available for follow-up. I think that's still a decent number, okay? They looked at the time to procedure, the number of Cocker's criteria, and the hip effusion appearance was actually similar in both of these groups, okay? What was interesting and impressive, I thought, was the time to procedure was about 8 hours from the moment of presentation. Which is, I think, something that we should all aspire to. 27% of those who had a needle washout, okay, so 12 out of 45 patients had to have an arthrotomy performed later. In 9 kids, that was after just one aspiration lavage. In 2, that was after 2. And in 1 child, that was after 3. Now, you've got to wonder what happened. That meant they thought, okay, we'll take them 3 times to the operating theatre. This was performed in the OR under a GA. And then finally thought, right, let's do an open. There was a revision arthrotomy rate in the arthrotomy group, and this was 9%, so significantly lower. Now, unsurprisingly, the pain scores were higher at 24 hours in the arthrotomy group, but actually that was a VAS of 5 out of 10 compared to 4 out of 10 in the lavage group, the needle group. But they said this was statistically significant, but that's clinically important, I'm not sure. And surprise, surprise, the scar kind of acceptance rates were lower in the needle washout group. So these guys concluded actually that the complication rates being so high and the need for arthrotomy so high in the needle group meant that open arthrotomy is probably the better option. The final and important conclusion, I think, was that there were no long-term complications in either of these groups. So if you are going to do needle washouts, I think the lessons would be you've got to watch these kids carefully, as we say you should. You might have to do repeated washouts. And if you are having to do repeated washouts, maybe you should consider sending them to someone who can do an open arthrotomy. I think this paper doesn't give me, it kind of reinforces my view right now that I'd be happier opening up the hip than actually performing needle washouts. But what did you guys think? Is it going to change your practice?
I'm not sure how many units in the UK actually have access to aspiration, because my understanding was always that if you're going to aspirate these, you need to have access to ultrasound at the very least, rather than doing them under GA. And in my view, if you're going to aspirate, then the only advantage is if you can do that without an anaesthetic, isn't it? That's the real advantage for young children if you're going to aspirate and avoid a general anaesthetic. And I'm not sure how many units in the country have access to that. More importantly, how many have access in all hours of the day, because this could be out of hours, weekends. It's not something that I've ever practiced, but in many ways it's reassuring that perhaps the algorithm I use is probably the better one, according to this paper, of an arthrotomy.
Yeah, I think what I really thought was brilliant was that they were really quite honest. Because it, usually the unit which comes up with a procedure or recommends a procedure will always be the champion for that procedure, come what may, irrespective of the outcome. And actually they said, well, now we've looked at it and actually probably it's not the best thing to do. So that's hopefully it's putting this to bed somewhat.
Yeah. Until the next group publish a paper to say no, it was all right. I completely agree with what you say, Alwyn. And what's interesting, where I work, when I started 10 years ago, our radiologists would aspirate these hips in children down in radiology, but they got fed up because the nursing staff kept filling in incident forms saying that they were inflicting pain. So they've actually stopped doing that. And I think it's probably harder to get those done now than it used to be. So yeah, it's certainly not something we'd consider. That's two papers about septic hip. Now, there's a paper that I reckon a lot of people will have seen because it was in the BJJ, and we try to look at journals other than the main ones that we all read. But I thought this was a really good paper and an interesting one. So it's How Common Are Refractures in Childhood, a study based on 40,000 pediatric fractures from the Swedish Fracture Register by Amilon et al. And it's from Gothenburg, and it was published in the August edition of the BJJ. They have a fracture database. I mean, the Swedes have a database for everything within orthopedics, don't they? They are the mother and father of all databases. But they looked at their database over a five-year period, just over May 2015 to December 2020, and essentially looked at children and their refracture rate. So it was really that simple. You can imagine it must have been quite a simple study once you've got all the data being collected. And what they found was that the overall fracture rate within 1 year was 0.88%. So the diaphyseal forearm fractures had a higher rate at 3.4%. The tibia was about 0.9%. Diaphyseal humerus was also slightly raised, but still pretty low numbers overall. But I suppose a significant number, and especially for your diaphyseal ones, you know, you just think, well, 3%, is that high or not? Now, the main weakness of this study is they didn't actually look at how those fractures were treated. So we have no idea whether they were casted or fixed. And I think that is a big problem with this paper. So I'm going to assume in my head that these were non-operative kind of management of patients. And what they showed with their Kaplan-Meier graphs was that the risk of refracture levels out at 90 days after a distal forearm fracture and about 180 days after diaphyseal forearm. And the reason why I think that's significant is what they've suggested is if you have a distal radius fracture, you should therefore avoid what they call risk activities for 3 months. And if you have a forearm fracture, you should advise avoiding those activities for 6 months. And I think that's a really interesting number. Now, we discussed this in our last podcast, didn't they, where they did a survey, the Americans, and found that actually everyone's recommending very different things. But what do you guys think about that? So telling someone with a diaphyseal forearm fracture, a child, that they're not allowed to get back to what you defined as risk activities for 6 months, is that in keeping with your advice as it stands, or would you normally let them get back sooner?
Usually a lot sooner. So, you know, I think most of us that all people that I know of would usually say plaster off, back to gymnastics, full contact football after 4 weeks. Usually we'd say something like that. No trampolines for 4 weeks. That's a common statement, isn't it? So to say it ought to be a lot longer is quite, well, I guess it's based on the science, but yeah. I'm not sure how practical families would find that, especially kids who play football, etc. For them, it's a huge social component, isn't it, of growing up, of making bonds. So they would find that really difficult to avoid for a period of, we're talking 90 days or 180 days.
Yeah. And I think what you actually need is like an NNT to say, look, if you stop people from doing with the diaphyseal forearm fractures for 6 months, how many refractures are you actually stopping?
Preventing, yeah.
Because actually you don't necessarily know that waiting will prevent that many anyway in the first instance. So, yeah, I think it's a bit harsh to keep kids off sport for for that long. And you know, the psychosocial aspects, as Owen's already talked about, maybe more than the risk of refracture.
I guess what it you know, look at being a glass half full kind of guy, I'd say you can probably tell parents that if you get beyond 90 days, then actually he should be safe. Or if you get beyond 180 days, then again, you know, there shouldn't be any reason why you should be upset or worried, because that's a huge worry for parents, isn't it? You know, will he break his arm again? Will it be strong enough when he falls, when he plays rugby, if he tackles, falls to the ground, will it break again? But I guess you can give them some kind of reassurance that if you get beyond a certain threshold, then it should be safe.
Yeah, and I suppose that number actually, so we're going, I'm saying, wow, okay, 3.4% compared to 0.88%. You could argue that 3% is actually quite a low percentage, isn't it? If parents ask, what are the chances of them breaking again? And you say 3%, and that will get back to normal by 6 months. Actually, that's probably quite reassuring, I think. I think so. It would have been good to have more detail about the injuries, about the management and how the refractures occurred. But you can imagine you can't put that into one paper like that. So I thought what they've done is really good. But again, it's one of those ones where you just want more detail to it. And maybe we'll see things coming from it in a kind of, how does fixation affect your rate of refracture and things?
Yeah.
Because that's, do you guys take that into account when you're managing these fractures, in a kind of how sporty the person is or what kind of activities they do as to whether you're going to fix or not?
Yeah, you know, I think that the whole move or the fashion of flexi nailing is all about refractures, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and that's why if you have your fracture treated by, say, an adult trauma surgeon, you're more likely to have a plate fixation in some hospitals, whereas most pediatric orthopedic surgeons will be saying, well, this needs a flexi nail. And I think that's driven the whole ethos of a long bone total fixation from top to bottom to try and kind of prevent refracture. I think that's a huge change, isn't it, over the last 20 years. And there's probably a difference in practice across the UK depending on which unit you turn up to.
Yeah, definitely. Right. And now moving on to my last paper, which was, you know, I really like this. Okay. So I can see Alpesh is really not impressed with the level of science that I'm producing today. But they're little topics, okay? There are topics that are kind of, that I find interesting. And this one I've already put into practice. Last week I did this. So this paper is called Slow Motion Smartphone Video Improves Inter-Observer Reliability of Gait Assessment in Ambulatory CP. Alpesh, as a gait analysis, is shaking his head. But I think that's it. That's the paper, and that's what they showed. Okay, so this is published in JCO. It's in volume 17, issue 4, which was published in the last 3 months. And it's from UCLA. And so it must be one of their better papers, because that's when the Americans choose to publish in JCO, is when they've got really hard-hitting science. If it hadn't gotten to JCO, I'm sure that's when they go to JPO and JBJS. Essentially, what they did was compare slow motion video gait analysis on your iPhone 10, okay, not even your 14, with normal speed gait analysis. And I have to say, I thought this was such a simple little idea. And yeah, there was a little bit of science there, okay? They said that they got the participants to watch someone walking with cerebral palsy and score them using the Edinburgh gait score. They had 10 in one group, 11 in the other, in terms of people doing the assessments. And they range from medical student through to attendings and non-clinical gait specialists. And essentially, you put your details onto a website and then it randomized you to watch either the slow motion videos or the normal speed videos. You could watch them as many times as you want, and you filled in the score. And what they found was that the intra-class coefficient was 0.65. So in your ratings, that would be good with slow-mo, whilst it was 0.57 for normal speed, which is fair. And what did make sense to me was they found that there were bigger jumps in terms of improvement with the less experienced assessors. So if you're someone who's used to doing gait analysis, then you could watch it at normal speed and things don't change too much. And so I was reading this and thinking, well, actually, this would be a great learning tool, because that's one of the things, and it's so simple. And yes, they talked about standing 3 feet, you know, having your phone 3 feet above the ground. But I have to say, last week I was doing it for someone who didn't have cerebral palsy, and watching it in slow-mo did make a difference. So yes, this isn't science at all. It could have been a technical tip, but they've put a little bit of science behind there. But I think it's something in terms of things that are discussed and published that maybe a lot of our listeners, surgeons and physios and other AHPs, could put into practice. But Alpesh still looks pretty grumpy about this paper.
Is this going to put him out of business? Is that why?
But the thing is, if you look at the Edinburgh, you know, gait score, it's a load of sort of categorical variables. So you can't use an ICC. I've always bring it down to this. You cannot use an ICC in this way. And they didn't even tell you which ICC they use. The stats are completely off. The numbers mean nothing. Literally, they could have just made those numbers up. So we use this completely inappropriately. You know, they went through all the effort of doing a randomized controlled trial, didn't they? Then decided it's a completely stupid method to analyze things. It makes sense, doesn't it? Slow motion could be great. What about slow motion with some markers on, with some vectors? It'd be amazing. Genius. Someone should do that. They really should.
That is a great idea, but the ping pong balls that I use in my clinic just keep falling off. It's not making a difference.
Yeah, no, I mean, it makes sense that slow motion is probably a good thing, but it would be nice, and actually with those data, it'd be nice if they actually could show that in a more robust way. That would have been good.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys will know this better than me, but has there not been a study that looked at gait analysis versus no gait analysis, or gait analysis versus just clinical examination in decision-making for CP?
Yeah, well, Uni Narayan and... quite a highly cited paper about that.
My bunch of papers. So all of the papers that we're talking about are available on the show notes. So wherever you've downloaded this from, there will be show notes and you can get all the references there. Okay. Right, Alpesh.
Okay, great. So sort of two main focuses. First, equality and diversity. So four of us Asian guys discussing equality and diversity. So the BJJ from July 2023. Downey et al. And the Borco Collaborative out of Edinburgh. So the role of gender in operative autonomy and orthopedic surgical trainees, GHOST. I love a good acronym. Perceived inequality has been cited as the reason that students or doctors may not pursue a certain field, for example, TNO, and maybe related to differential exam passing rates and drivers to leave training as well, maybe due to fewer training opportunities. So the purpose of this study was to determine whether gender influences operative training and surgical autonomy for UK TNO trainees. So a retrospective study looking at logbooks, which can store all variety, all manner of evils. But anyway, 274 UK orthopaedic trainees and comparing cases by sex with some assessment of less than full-time trainees and people who'd had out-of-program experiences. So the primary outcome was the percentage of cases undertaken as lead surgeons, supervised and then also unsupervised. So 65% men, 33% women, nearly 300,000 cases documented. So lots of numbers, main upshots. Males were lead surgeons on 3% more cases than females. Interestingly, when you break this down to autonomous operating, the rates were essentially similar, 23% versus 22%. There were smaller numbers when looking at people having had out-of-program experience, less than full-time training. So I'm not really sure you can infer too much from that. Now, again, I'm going to bring it down to the stats. I found them a bit confusing, to be honest. I think it's a bit risky. If you're going to make some big assertions about something, I think the methodology needs to be really robust. It may well be robust. I just felt like I needed more information. So, you know, in their outcomes and confounders section, percentages, they said, were used instead of raw numbers to account for different durations of training, and confounding variables were also identified. However, they used a chi-square test for most of their analysis. So that doesn't account for any confounders, and you don't use percentages in the chi-square test. You can't, because you need to know the exact numbers. So, you know, maybe they did things right, but they just didn't describe it very well, and I didn't understand, or maybe I just didn't understand it. But, you know, I think it, as a retrospective study, I think what's in people's logbooks is quite variable, and how people code things as well. So subject to a lot of bias. I think the general spin of the paper was that there is a gender bias. This may or may not be true, but, you know, you wonder why the autonomous operating between the sexes was the same. So maybe it suggests that, you know, to achieve this level, women need to be supervised, you know, less. I don't know. I think you can interpret the findings in different ways. You ultimately need a prospective study with contemporaneously logged data, not by the person doing the operation as well, to really assess test this hypothesis. But yeah, it kind of does link with my next paper. Any comments about that paper? I know you feel quite strongly about this as well. And so,
yeah, I think it raises some good messages, but I agree with you. I'm just not sure that the results and the methodology are strong enough to justify what is a really good message. It was a voluntary survey, wasn't it? So people sent their logbooks in if they wanted to. And that's one of the problems, I think, with this paper is I think there'll be a lot of people, some who just couldn't be bothered to do this. And I suspect that might have shown a bigger difference if you had the people that really don't care about this type of research sending in their logbooks. And I also worry that there might be some people who maybe felt their numbers were too low and didn't want to participate in a study like this. So I think this is a good piece of work. But as you said, I think it should form the basis for a more prospective study. I think it's something we should all bear in mind, like a lot of the papers we've talked about today. I think when you are training someone, you might want to bear this paper in mind and think about whether you need to adapt your training style to the person that you're training. But I think it's a lot more complex than just gender.
Yeah, and I think the basic message and how it should provoke our consciousness is that we ought to be less conditioned. We need to be aware of our biases as a community of surgeons. So from a very kind of practical common sense point of view, I think this kind of paper has a really important message. Though it's not just about gender, there are many other diversity groups that ought to benefit. You know, I think four of us sitting here represent a very large diversity issue, especially with non-training professionals being largely made up of international medical graduates. So I think there's a whole before I diverge too much, that's a really big a question that needs to be answered by the healthcare community in Britain as to whether equality of access, equality of achievement is uniform across healthcare. That's a big question to answer.
And you could argue that that could be done at a national level by a higher authority, just looking as these people did at people's logbooks via ICP. And I think, Alwyn, when you talk about the non-training grades, I think that would be a really interesting group to focus on, wouldn't it? There's a lot of work going into that area because we know that they're an important part of our workforce now and probably going to become more important as time goes by, or I'd say undoubtedly. And I think we need to look at the experience they're getting as well.
Yeah, so sort of leading on from this paper, we've got a paper from JAMA Surgery, August this year, from Wallace et al. Out of Toronto. So surgeon sex and long-term post-operative outcomes among patients undergoing common surgery.
Well, this paper provoked a huge amount of discussion on the consultant WhatsApp group in Leicester. I suspect that might have been repeated across the country. But yes, thank you for choosing this.
Yes, I'll just a quick summary. So their research question was, is there an association between surgeon sex and outpatients' long-term post-operative outcomes? So they had a million patients, and lots of patients. Those treated by a female surgeon were less likely to experience death, hospital readmission, or major complications at 90 days or 1 year after surgery. And this went across the board with all the different surgical specialties. It was adult, actually, not pediatric. And some specialties had bigger differences than others. And that was particularly interesting. And orthopedics obviously was included there. I thought that their paper was really well written because they put in all the confounding variables in their regression modeling. The stats seemed very good. And I think they were quite circumspect and balanced about their discussion, highlighting that association, not causation, but actually an increased body of evidence to suggest that women have better surgical outcomes than men. And in the same issue, there was a paper that suggested that whilst women take longer with lap colies, their outcomes are better. And we've all worked with the surgeon whose main goal is to finish the operation as quick as possible. In my experience, they've never been a female surgeon. And so it highlights that isn't necessarily always the best objective. So I thought it was going back to GHOST. Maybe the boys do need more training. They need more cases because they're not as good as the girls. And actually, if we're talking about competency-based training, then we should be titrating and adjusting the numbers according to the needs of the trainee.
The other question, sorry, Anish.
No, I'll
you all. No, I was the other the other question that I thought was quite interesting was it doesn't answer why women might be better, because it could, it doesn't necessarily mean it's just about the surgery. It could be about choice, so decision making. It could be about the surgery, but it could also be post-operative care that there are differences in. It's not necessarily just about technique. And that would be a really interesting debate in itself, you know, in terms of how men and women perhaps manage clinical reasoning in a different way.
Yeah, it's decisions, not incisions, as they say, right? And I guess, you know, that's, you're making a really good point, Alfred, that maybe based on that paper, we need to put Ghost, turn it upside down and say, where are we going wrong with male trainees? What can we do to make them better? And yeah, maybe they need a bit more supervision and they need to watch a bit more before they jump in and do things. I don't know. But yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? But both papers raise awareness and show us that there needs to be further work done in these areas. Right, mate, you've got a couple more papers you're going to discuss.
Yeah, so guided growth, a couple of interesting papers. So McGinley et al. From TSRH and JBJS American from August. So faster rate of correction with distal femoral transphyseal screws versus plates in hemiepiphysodesis for coronal plane knee deformity. So in this retrospective study, they looked at the correction rates for guided growth. They had two comparator groups, one where they used a kind of tension band plate and the other where they used a metazoo-type kind of transphyseal screw. They undertook some propensity matching to try and get some comparable population characteristics. So they had baseline and follow-up imaging, and that was all on EOS, so hopefully less prone to projection error. I mean, there are some potential criticisms one could make with the paper, but essentially they showed that using the transphyseal screws, the correction rates were quicker for LDFA and for the mechanical axis as well. So they suggested that, you know, especially if you're running out of time with the patient, maybe that's what you're going to go for. Equal complication rates between the two. So this was interesting because I universally use 8 plates. I never use these screws. And actually, I've had a few conversations recently. And, you know, those scars sometimes are really horrible from the 8 plates, I find. And maybe we should be using these more.
And the French will say, told you so. Just like they're going to win the World Cup. In rugby, they're going to say this is a double victory. So there we go.
I do tend to use them at the distal tibia. I think the metazoo screw works really well there. I've not been brave enough to use them at the knee, only because I suppose what I'm not sure about is, so as they said, it's useful in those approaching maturity. I wasn't sure what the long-term consequences would be in terms of physeal damage if you've got this screw that you may not have passed in one smooth go. And what happens with rebound and things. And that's the only thing I thought that was missing in this paper, because it was an older population. They didn't talk about the risk of rebound or those longer term complications of growth arrest. But yeah, definitely for me, I was thinking, right, when you see them at 13 and you think you've got to get in there and do something, this would be a nice way of doing it.
Yeah. So I think I thought particularly it's like with valgus knees that you're correcting who are having patellofemoral instability and you might do an MPFL later, it's nice to go through some virgin territory for your MPFL. I think especially in that indication I might change my practice. And I think you mentioned about multiple passes, so this so then there was a cautionary tale from the J. Posner papers, Saunders and Shaw from May, where they were using two screws for epiphysiodesis completely, but they had a periprosthetic fracture. And they said one of the issues was repeated passes of the wire. So they suggested a kind of retrograde technique with the wire and antrograde with the screw. I guess a bit like you with the wiring, what you might do for a Soltaris II distal femur. So that might reduce your passes for your metazoo technique, but you obviously have to go across the joint. Would you consider that?
You know, it's not a technique that I've had a huge amount of exposure to. I'm a dedicated 8-plate person, but I guess we wait to see what comes out of this and whether it becomes a more popular technique. But it's not something that I've personally seen in training or in practice.
Okay, fair enough. So then just linked in and to that paper, or the last two and the last podcast, there was a paper from JPO in July, Grote et al. From Shriners St. Louis, and they looked at correction rates in after hemiepiphysodesis in patients with X-linked hypophosphatemic rickets. So we were talking about that last time. So it was a retrospective review, 24 patients. And then they had a control group, which was not entirely a control group, but anyway, just a comparative group. And essentially, and these patients were not treated with burismab, but vitamin D and phosphate supplementation. So kind of standard old style treatment. And they found that correction in X-linked hyperphosphatemic rickets was the distal femur was 15 to 36% slower than the controls. What was odd is that actually they found that more patients were less likely to fully correct, but also more patients were to higher risk of overcorrecting as well, which was a bit confusing. So maybe a few got lost to follow up and then were picked up later on. So I think the findings weren't entirely surprising because we know there's reduced growth rates. But similarly, if it's going to take a while, if you're running out of time, that might be when you change your approach potentially.
Yeah. Do you know, the place where I was wondering about screws, so one is in those older children, because it was quite convincing, wasn't it? It was 0.5 for the plates versus 0.77 degrees per month for the screw. The other place is the distal femur. So a lot of people are using 8 plates anteriorly, or certainly used to, when you're trying to get rid of those flexion deformities. And I just find that that's a horrible place to be putting 8 plates. But some people have reported using screws, haven't they? So you're passing the screw over that kind of part of the physis. And that's another area where I was thinking that might actually work as well, so that you're not violating the joint. It's definitely something I'd consider.
Right. So I think those were my main papers. I had a couple of other quite funny ones. I mean, I love the acronyms. There was a buckled trial.
Well, I think so. Very quickly, what did they say? They said, so this was this randomized as well?
My main question was why? Why would you do it?
100%. Why
would you do an ultrasound instead of an X-ray?
Instead of two X-rays, we get 6 ultrasound views. So for the listener, this is comparing ultrasound with X-ray to diagnose fractures of the distal radius.
Yeah, in New England Journal of Medicine, Snelling it out. Amazing. Primary endpoint was promise at 4 weeks. They all do well. Great. You could flip a coin. You have a fracture, you don't have a fracture. I'm going to treat you the same. Oh, we've got 4 weeks. That's brilliant. This flipping the coin technique's brilliant. It's much easier than X-rays, you know.
Yeah. Well, I wondered if it was maybe pecuniary issues here. Can you charge more for an ultrasound than an X-ray? Okay.
I don't know. You drop a couple of milli on a trial, you think, come on, guys, let's, you know. Let's
come on, it's a randomized control trial. Better than the smartphone slow-mo gait analysis paper. This is higher science. And then, mate, the single heel raise test paper that you wanted to talk about. So 25 is the magic number. Is that right?
This was because of my penchant for toe walking and looking at outcomes after hoax for toe walking. So we've got a pilot study coming up. And one of the things we're measuring is single heel raises, because obviously if you really weaken them, they're going to have to, and give them enough length, they have to walk with their feet flat because they're so weak. So we assume that their strength gets better, but we're not sure if it does. So that's one thing we're looking at. So actually having a normative group, although this patient population will not be representative of ours necessarily, but having a guide is quite useful. So that, when was that? That was a Journal of Foot and Ankle Surgery. This came out of Karnataka, Mishra et al. And that was from the last couple of months as well. So it's not rocket science. They just measured kids going up and down, up and down, up and down, quite a lot, 500 kids. We have some numbers of a normal group that we should expect.
And do you know what? I love that test, because I didn't know that there was science behind it, but I did come across it just out of chance, because I realized that when kids can hop, or when kids can do a single stance raise, is usually the time when they are fully recovered from, say, an injury or casting, and it's usually the time when their limp is no longer obvious. So even in the context of trauma immobilization, I've realized that once kids can hop or do a single stance shoe raise, then they're probably back to their pre-injury athletic ability. So that was just an interesting point for something that I'd come across before.
Well, I have to say, for me, I used to say you have to be able to do 10. Now I'm going to have to make them do 25 in clinic.
I mean, no one ever got to do. I routinely take my metronome in to work, actually, just so I can have it 60 beats a minute, because otherwise they're not doing it properly.
But now you can do it on your mobile phone, so you can leave your metronome at home and you can do slow-mo video as well. You can do everything on there. Soon you'll be able to do an ultrasound for a fracture on your phone as well.
Right. So guys, thank you very much, Alwin. Are you guys going to be, so in terms of things coming up in our society, we've got BOA coming up next. Time flies. Are you guys going to be going to BOA?
Yes. Yep.
Brilliant. Alpesh?
Unfortunately not this time. No.
Okay. So BizCos are running a couple of good sessions. So there's going to be a joint session with Bofas talking about foot and ankle. And there's going to be a trauma update as well. So I think that'll be really good. Free papers as well. And if you are listening to this and you haven't signed up, on the Friday, BizCos are running a whole session for registrars. They're going to be face-to-face lectures and workshops with Sawbones and patients. So if you are going to BOA and you can be there for the Friday and you want to join in, you'll have seen the emails. This has been sent out, but in case you didn't see those, please give, or you could reach out to any of us and we can put you in touch with, but and Roger Walton, who are the main people organizing this, or Emily Bed. So give any of us a shout and we can get you on there. Right. Any points before we let you all go?
No, it's been a great pleasure to be honored to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. And I'm glad that I wasn't the only one in a silly shirt.
But mate, now that you mentioned the shirt and the photo will be seen, does anyone know what this shirt is all about? Has anyone seen the Barbie film?
Not yet.
Ah, I see.
That was a diplomatic answer.
Yeah. It is great. It is a really good film. There was Barbie, Oppenheimer. I actually went to see Barbie first. I didn't fall asleep in Barbie, but I don't think that was Oppenheimer's fault. But this is, it's a Ken shirt. Okay, so if you know, you know. But yeah, do check out those films. We didn't talk about the other bits today because there was just too much science to discuss. So yeah, sorry about that, guys. But next time we will definitely do that. Right. Okay. So thank you very much for listening. And we will see you in a few months' time for the next one. Take care, guys. Bye-bye.
Thank you.